The hour of 10:15 having arrived, we will call the meeting of the Tax Committee to order when we have a quorum, but we will get started as it is 10:15. Before us today, members, and again we'll break in to do some administrative things here. Today is estate tax day, or some would say death tax day, and so we have three bills that are basically the same. So we have three authors. I'd like to call all three authors up to the table if we could. It'd be my intention to have the authors describe the bill, and then we'll see if there's folks in the audience that wish to talk in favor of the death tax or with concerns on the death tax. So we do have a quorum, so we'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order on this day, Thursday, the 29th of January. So with that, if the three authors could please introduce themselves, and then you can talk amongst yourselves to see who wants to present what. Then we'll have a little summary from Mr. Michael. We'll have questions, and then we'll go into folks. I have on my list of Beth Cadoon from the Chamber, Stephanie from Owl Bookkeeping, Mr. Hickey from the NFIB, Mr. Skilbred from the Bankers, and Mr. Busselman from the Farm Bureau. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify for or with concerns on the bills? Could you state, just let us know what your name is?
Peter Nelson, Center of the American Experiment.
Okay, are you supporting the bills or not supporting
supporting.
The bills? Support, I didn't support it. Do you get his name? Peter Nelson.
Chairman Scott Nelson, I'm in the CPA Society.
Are you Peter's brother?
Not, as far as I know.
Scott Peter and his other brother, Daryl? Yeah. Okay, with that, we do have a quorum. So, Representative Petersburg moves the minutes of January 28th. Any additions or corrections? Hearing or seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Okay, with that, who's the senior there? Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and fellow members of the Tax Committee. My colleagues and I are here. Our bills are identical, so just a quick outline. All three of our bills would bring the estate tax exclusion in Minnesota in compliance or conformity with the federal level. Right now that's set at $5.43 million in index for inflation. You know, this is something that has been discussed frequently and I think almost annually in this committee, and I think it's time that we take the step to bring this. I know that some of the discussion around this topic was had. I believe you may have had discussions, Mr. Chairman, when we did the federal conformity bill, but perhaps there wasn't time to move that with the rapid pace of that bill and the importance of moving that quickly. So I'm hoping as you look to put together a tax bill that this will be something that will be included. It's very important for small businesses, farmers, and others, but just also with regards to our state's competitiveness and keeping businesses and people in the state of Minnesota. You know, part of the, the back and forth on our estate tax and the exclusion has been, stems a little bit from some of the changes at the federal level. You know, the threshold was increased at the federal level, then it went away for a year and then came back, and then finally in 2012, the Congress reached a compromise and the threshold was set at $5 million for the exclusion and index for inflation. So I think we've finally got a stable tax policy from the federal level from which to base our policy and move forward. Finally, you know, Minnesota is one of a small group of states, and that group is shrinking with regards to still having an estate tax, which is with the exclusion that is less generous on the federal level. And it is something that, you know, a number of magazines that track business activities and financial things are listing Minnesota as one of the states not to die in for the current year 2015 and beyond. So, you know, when you've got states including New York, Governor Cuomo indicating that, you know, they've made changes that they can't be the state that people rush from when they're getting up in years to basically try to protect their states, their estates for their heirs. I think Minnesota's the same way. We don't want to do anything more to encourage people from moving their assets. We want to encourage estates and family businesses in particular to stay in Minnesota and continue to have those business and those assets stay here. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, maybe a few comments. Representative Detmer, then Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And committee members, you know, I asked Representative Loon to sit between us because we needed a rose between two thorns as we present this these good pieces of legislation here. And it was a couple years ago that I actually decided that, in this case it's House 148, to take a look at what would be the best tax piece of legislation to bring through Minnesota. And talking to House research and different people and constituents, they said the adopting the federal exclusion for our tax, estate taxes. So Representative Loon basically said it well, so I don't need to go on beyond that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Deppman. Representative Albright?
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity of listening to our case. The reasons for elimination of the estate tax are many, but not the least of which is the imposition of higher income costs on Minnesota workers and families, then can be justified, literally, as you've seen in your packets, by this small net increase in tax revenue to the state. It imposes an enormous incentive for distortion of decisions in economically damaging ways. It also discourages savings and investment as well as promoting tax avoidance. In our contemporary setting, the estate tax fails in many circles the standard criteria for an efficient and equitable tax instrument. Its collection is unrelated to any burden placed on society by the taxpayer and candidly can have inequitable effects on the well-being of the decedent's survivors. And for many, it is a tax on what is mostly the accumulation of labor income that has already been taxed at the time of receipt. As we've looked at the information and what you will hear from the testifiers this morning, there are several studies that have found that the elimination of this tax would and has in other states that had the respondent effects of higher economic output, higher employment, and a stronger growth of both state and local tax collections. That being said, and for the sake of what Representatives Loon and Detmer have said, I think there's also some corollaries to that in terms of why people move from state to state. Just much as we've heard about the migration patterns of birds, I think it also is appropriate to think about the migration of people from state to state. Some would argue that people move from state to state based upon school, family, retirement, better jobs, the outdoors, quality of government services. When you're considering the climate that we live in compared to Arizona, obviously for warmer climes, cost of living, and most assuredly as a consideration in terms of low taxable rates. But some would argue that Minnesota moves primarily, some Minnesotans move for warmer climates. What's interesting is that the IRS has done some study on this that also suggests that there are some migration patterns that aren't as noticeable. Many of the migration patterns that we've observed coming out of Minnesota are to cities that aren't predominantly for where people retire, but where they are economic centers, such as Atlanta, Seattle, Dallas, Austin, Sioux Falls, and Denver. And as we've seen, migration and patterns during the Great Recession that we've just come through, there wasn't the bump that we saw in terms of those states where they were receiving income coming out of Minnesota into other economic centers. I'd also draw your attention to the fact that the tracking data from the IRS also talks to the fact that it's noticeable in terms of people not moving into the state for the very reasons that we're at this table this morning. So with that, happy to answer any questions or wait until after the testifiers complete their comments to you as well.
Thank you, Representative Albright. First of all, I will move at this point House File 82 then the motion will be delayed over for possible inclusion, but so we actually have it before us. I'll do each of these at the end of, and we'll each of these at the end of the hearing today, so we move House File 82 just so we have a bill before us at this point. Members, just a little history, and then I'd like to call on Mr. Michael to make a few comments on the history on this issue. And we wanted to get all the bills we had regarding the death tax together at one time here, and actually they are basically the same bills. But in 2011, in the bill that was passed, I had worked very hard with Governor Dayton, and I do thank him. It was, I wouldn't say contentious, because I would never get contentious. Your reserved, quiet, withdrawn, and measured chair would never do that. But we had a lively debate, I'll say. And the result of the 2011 tax bill in July was that what we would do is we would basically comply with the feds for farmers under certain circumstances and small business under certain circumstances. Because farmers, you know, when it was $1 million, a farmer with 160 acres, all of a sudden on paper it's worth $10,000 an acre, $1.6 million, plus any equipment or livestock he'd have. They'd have to sell part of the farm to pass it down to a son or daughter. Now, we're not talking about the 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 acre farmers or 10,000 like Torkelson or anything like that. We're not talking about that. We're talking about 160 acres, 240 acres, the small guys. And so they're getting hit very hard. So the law now says that if you keep it in the family, stays in the family for 3 years, and other qualifiers, that you can go to the federal level. Now, I also should thank Chair Lincheski and Chair Skoy from last year for getting Minnesota on a trajectory to move it up. And I think it'll at some point goes over $2 million. Maybe Mr. Michael can give us the current law where we're at. Now, this is one, as I said, that your reserve, quiet, withdrawn, measured chairman gets a little cranky about, if you will. Because I've never understood this tax, and I'm not one of those falling off the right edge that says all taxes are bad, there should be no taxes. I mean, you have to have an income tax, you need sales tax. We have to have taxes. What does it say on the IRS building? Taxes are what we pay for a civilized society.
Yeah.
But I've never wanted to become that civilized. I mean, my gosh. But if you think about the death tax for just a second, and we'll open up for discussion, but if you think about the death tax for just a second, it's just not very Minnesota nice, if you think about it. I mean, here you have a family. Somebody died. They paid all their taxes on that money once, and now they're dead, and we stick it to them again. And that's just not very nice, in my opinion. So of all the taxes, in my mind, the death tax is an evil tax. Because somebody just died, you just had a death in the family, and oh, by the way, you've got to sell through your farms or your assets. And people say, well, should somebody really have $11 million or 12? You know what my answer is? Yeah, it's theirs. What right does the government have to come and confiscate property after death? So being reserved, quiet, withdrawn, and measured as I normally am, those are my thoughts. So you'll have to kind of see where I'm, and I know there's opposing views, which we will be hearing today. It's a double taxation. Somebody died. We come take your property, and that's not very nice. So with that, questions for the three authors, and if you could address a certain author that you'd like to answer the question. After that, we will get into people testifying on the bill. Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Loon. I'm just wondering, the current estate tax, the $1.4 million for 2015, what percentage of estates actually pay our current estate tax? And under your proposal, what percentage of estates will be paying the estate tax?
Chair Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I'd like to phone a friend, I think Mr. Michael might have that.
Mr. Michael, then if you could answer that, and then maybe before we go to more questions, Representative Lean still has the floor here.
Good.
But I'd like you to make a few comments on current law.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Moline, if you look at the second page of the revenue estimate, there is at the very the very last page, which is the third page, there's a last paragraph where it says number of taxpayers. And essentially what that says is that under present law, there are about 800 estates that would owe tax with the $1.4 million exclusion amount. Under the bill, that would drop to about 160 taxpayers. Typically, in Minnesota, about 40,000 people a year die. And so if you do the math on that, I think it works out that under current law, a little bit under 2% of people that die end up actually paying Minnesota estate tax. And under the bill, it would drop to about a quarter of 1% of estates, I think. I'd have to actually, somewhere in that range, though.
Okay, let's finish with Representative Moline. Then I'm going to go back to Mr. Michael. Representative Moline?
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, I just wanted clarity on that. So the current estate tax protects basically 98% of estates, and under the proposal, only 0.25% of estates would end up paying a sales tax, if I understood Mr. Michael correctly. So, you know, I just wanted clarity that this is the wealthiest of the wealthy estates, basically, that are going to fall under this proposal. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Loon.
Thank you, Representative Loon. Mr. Michael, or to that point, I'm sorry, Representative Loon, then we'll go to Mr.
Thank
Michael.
You, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Moline and committee members. I think you will hear from testimony coming up from some of the folks who, from the public coming forward, that part of the reason that you've got fewer taxpayers paying this is that they are planning and moving their estates and their assets out of state to avoid the tax and avoid this situation for their heirs. So it's not a situation where you've only got this number of people falling under it. It's that people are taking the time and going to the expense to plan to avoid the tax, and I think that's an important component to this discussion.
Representative Lee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess I would, you know, be interested to hear, Representative Loon, maybe you know the answer, but what happens when it's real property that's passing a large estate on Lake Minnetonka, for example, or Gull Lake, or wherever it may be? How are they able to shield that real property from estate tax liabilities?
Representative Loon.
Thank you, and I'm actually, Representative Albright would like to respond to that.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. In the context of real property, in most cases, at the death of the first, in a sense of a spouse, the property can be moved to the estate of the surviving spouse. But in the case where you have either a business and real estate holdings, they're under tax terms and tax mechanisms, you probably would go to establishing an AB trust situation with some other mechanisms that not avoid but transfer those assets to either the surviving spouse and or the progeny of that relationship down the road for future consideration of whatever tax or continuation of the business profile as well.
Representative Lee.
Thank you.
Mr. Michael, if you could give something. Now, I am kind of confused by some of these numbers here on the revenue note, because it said about 160, it would go to like 160 people with 100 owing tax. So that basically just means that my industry that I'm in real life has done a really, really good job, because and for full disclosure, I'm a financial planner, and of course we work very hard every day to make sure people don't pay death taxes because we think they're just nasty. So I can think of 160 people in my district that if they did no planning would be hit very severely by this, because you have a farmer at 300 acres, at 10,000 an acre, they're at 3 million. They're over the Minnesota side right now. Now, federally, they're fine. But, this bill really works against my industry, because we pass this bill. I don't do as much business because I don't have to help people legally save their estates for their families. Okay, Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just to give a couple-minute background on the Minnesota estate tax, for a period of time in the middle, before the passage of the 2001 federal tax bill, federal law allowed a 100% state death tax credit that essentially allowed states to impose an estate tax that was equal to that credit, so that the effect of that was that if a state imposed that a tax equal to that credit, all it did was reduce the estate's federal liability and did not increase their total estate tax liability. And Minnesota, along with every other state, had a tax that equaled that, the amount of that federal credit, and that was the only tax that Minnesota had from the middle 80s up until 2001. With the passage of the 2001 federal tax law, that federal credit got repealed and got converted to a deduction. At that point, it was essentially every state had to make a decision whether or not they would continue to actually have an estate tax or an inheritance tax for states that instead used that pattern that imposed a actual liability on estates. And Minnesota at that point, because we're an update state, in other words, congressional changes don't automatically affect Minnesota law, Minnesota chose not to essentially allow it to repeal its tax when that federal credit went away. And so Minnesota, starting in for people that died in 2002, had a real tax in the sense that it actually imposed a burden on the estate that was in addition to what they could get a credit for under the federal level. And that tax was allowed to just be whatever the federal credit was under the old federal law. And for the 12 years or 13 years until last year, we went along with that system. And from deaths from 2006 on, that basically created a $1 million threshold. It wasn't a true exemption, because people who were just a little bit over that essentially got their exemption clawed back at a faster rate than what the normal tax rate would be. So anyway, we went along with that scheme or mechanism for taxation until 2014. And as the chair mentioned, in 2011, the exemption or subtraction for qualified farmland and qualified small business property was provided. In 2014, the legislature enacted an actual standalone Minnesota tax that had its own rate schedule and its own exclusion amount. And at that point, the exclusion was set last year for deaths in 2014 at $1.2 million. And that exclusion increases in steps by $200,000 per year until it reaches $2 million for individuals that die in 2018. So that's sort of the, and the rates range from either ultimately in 2018 the rates will range between 9% and 16%. The rate under the old state death tax credit was, the top rate was 16%, but because of this goofy way that it was phased out or taken away, you actually had some estates that were paying tax rates at 41% on their value, so that the new rate schedule essentially sort of mirrors a little bit the old rate schedule. And so that's a little bit of the history of what's going on. And of course, all of the bills here would increase the exclusion to the amount of the federal, and because that would now be higher than our current zero bracket or exclusion amount plus the subtraction for farmland and qualified small businesses, all of these bills simplify that by just, you know, repealing that subtraction, and so basically everybody would get the $5.43 million exclusion without regard to whether they had farmland or small business property.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. I have Anderson, Lesh, and Loeffler. Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment on what Representative Albright talked about with the whole migration issue. I'm glad you brought that up. You know, right now in Minnesota, we're a loser. We have more deaths than we have births, and in particular in the youth, we're losing a lot of our young talent, and I think that's problematic. but also just the investments. They, you know, there's been articles written talking about Minnesota's turning into a rental state versus an owner state. I don't know if you have any comments on that and what that means to our communities and whatnot.
Mr. Albright, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, I think, you know, from my experience, and I share the same vocation as the chair does, but in my conversations with clients, it is becoming increasingly apparent that they're making residency decisions of 6 months and a day based upon other alternative states, not just because of retirement, but also where they can house their businesses because of the tax friendlier environment in terms of vacating the taxation structure for businesses as well. And when you're taking a look at bringing along the second and sometimes with clients third generation of the family ownership, it becomes very, very onerous in terms of the contingency planning for the inevitability of the first death and what happens with when dad dies and mom doesn't want to be in the business and you've got three or four sons in the business, where do they want to occupy? And as they look at the state of Minnesota as compared to other states, they're telling dad, we're interested in buying the business, but not if it stays in Minnesota.
Chair Anderson. Okay, before we go on, I've got a few more questions for the authors, but of the folks that I have listed to testify, is there anyone that's from more than 50 miles away? In case we would get bogged down here. Okay, so it's all roadies and groupies. Okay. So, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'll ask this question of Representative Loon. Representative Loon, why stop at $5.43 million? I realize that's the federal conformity, but if I'm to believe the testimony as offered already and the statements of the chair, I mean, why wouldn't we go higher than $5.43 million?
Representative Loon?
excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Lesh. Well, I think as part of this committee's mission is not only looking at things such as the points that Representative Albright brought up, how do we maintain competitiveness and making sure that we're keeping businesses, especially those that are passed from one generation in Minnesota, but also the principles of reducing the complexity and having a more simplified tax system and having conformity with the federal exclusion on this policy, I think meets those goals. And so I just think it's a sensible policy and a good place to land.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that answer, Representative Lewin. And I mean, I just start to wonder because I look at the burden of these folks that have $5.4 million in their estate value when they die, and how tough that must be to deal with the level of this estate value. And then I think about the people who have, say, $10 million or $15 million, and that's got to be really tough. I mean, my heart truly bleeds for them. What to do with $10 million? So I thought, you know, maybe we should extend it up because that's certainly got to be more difficult. But let me ask a different question. Now, I may be persuaded, not for, as Representative Aline mentioned, the guy with three yachts on Lake Minnetonka, but let's say you're a farm. Let's say you've got 3,000 acres in, for example, Preston, and you don't want to have to sell off a portion of those 3,000 acres in order to pay the tax on the farm. Some would think that's a reasonable prospect to shave the estate tax so that you can continue the growth and expansion of the family farm. But what I'm worried about also is not just those families that have a 3,000-acre farm in Preston, but what about these other aspiring farmers in Preston that want a piece of the action? They're waiting for available farmland or farmland to reduce in price. And if we allow these farms to continue on or to expand, you're not putting new farmland in the market. How are those aspiring farmers who don't have two nickels to rub together as yet, but they're looking to get into the market, how are they supposed to get into the market if we just allow these operations to corporatize and get bigger and bigger and bigger? How do those economics work?
I'll take that one. First of all, you can't have corporate farms in Minnesota, I believe.
Right.
You can't
do
that in the first place. Second of all, at $3 corn, there's a lot of farms for sale right now. I don't see any problem with the farmer in Preston being able to do that. But to go back to your first question, Representative Lesh, about, well, why stop at 4.5? I asked that, too. Blow the lid off it at the federal level and the state. There should not be an estate tax. There should not be a death tax. So for all the reasons Chair Loon stated, yeah, conform to the feds, it works, and it helps a lot of folks. But I don't think there should be any death tax, just so you know where I'm coming from. Now, we philosophically disagree here because I happen to believe that people's money is people's money. And I don't care how much somebody makes. I don't care how much somebody is worth. That's their business. I started with nothing, done fine. Okay? I did it. Okay? It wasn't the government that did it. I did it. Okay? So in the case of the farmer that has 3,000 acres paid for in Preston, that's his. That's not the government's. Government should be coming in and dividing things afterwards. Just a respectful, philosophical difference. I believe it's theirs. There are others that believe that it shouldn't be theirs. They've got enough. We should split it up. Just, that's fair. That's fair. You have the floor, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did Representative Loon have an answer?
Or Albright, Loon? Representative Loon?
Chair no, Loon? I would concur with the chair.
A wise move, Chair, always. But, you know, I have wondered, Mr. Chair, you brought this up, as a person being in this industry, and all of the hardworking accountants and tax attorneys and financial planners who are slaving away 24/7 at their fax machines, trying to save money for folks, these hardworking Minnesotans that have north of $2 million right now and in the state, and we may lose their jobs. So is this an anti-jobs bill, Mr. Chair?
This bill is a job killer.
There you go.
I have done quite well helping people not pay estate taxes. Just right up front, and I made that a disclaimer. This is my thing. But when I get the call from a client of mine that says that they're moving to state X, Y, or Z because you people in Minnesota are nuts, and don't quote, I would never say that. That's a direct quote.
I think the tape is on, Mr.
Whatever. It should be on the front page. But when I get those calls, for example, I had a friend who was very successful. He worked hard, started from nothing. He's a very, very wealthy guy. Goes down to Florida every year. Usually comes back in about March. And so I call him up, say, hey, how you doing? You coming up, like to have supper with you. He said, well, I'm going to stay a couple more months down here. And the red flags go off. And I go, oh, geez, we lost another one. And sure enough, 6 months in a day, they go to the Quick Trip or Motor Mart or whatever they have down there, and they buy a pack of gum with a receipt so they can say that they were there. And it doesn't have to be that way, is all I'm saying. Representative Lesh.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And what you're talking about is you're talking about taking it from the folks who pay taxes on their estates. And this is an old idea. This is essentially, we're America. The pilgrims came over here, landed on Plymouth Rock, and we don't have aristocracy anymore, where you just pass the wealth down one line and the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, and that's the way it was in the old country. No, we do have estate tax because we understand you got where you are, not just on your own. I went to public schools. I drive on public roads. I use public services, and everyone got there that way, especially the big trucks used to ship grain. We need to make sure the roads are strong enough to ship those big trucks down the road, and we're all in this together. So, no, it's not completely on your own that you got bigger, and when you get bigger, it's certainly you use more resources than the other folks that just drives a Toyota down the road. So I just want to note that we're taking it from south of 2% to, as Mr. Michael says, 0.25%. Now, if that's not aristocracy, I don't know what is. So I think the estate tax, Mr. Chair, is a great American tradition to make sure we don't turn into an aristocracy or an oligarchy. And I understand you feel like I got here completely on my own. I'm starting to do better and better, Mr. Chair. I'm owning more property. And I'm looking down the barrel someday of maybe potentially an estate tax. But you're right. You and I have a difference in philosophy. We look at it different ways, and I say at some point, I know I didn't get here completely on my own. So I'm just hoping we don't lose too many of your colleagues in your profession. Although I know you would survive, Mr. Chair, because you're very good at it.
Mr. Chair.
Well, to that point there, first of all, I already paid for the schools. On all this money that's in my estate, I already paid for the schools. And I paid a lot for the schools. And glad to do it. I just don't want to do it twice, is what I'm saying. First of all, and I would ask Mr. Michael, You said, Mr. Michael, it's, or somebody said it's like 0.25%. My guess is that that's not the top 2% that are getting hit here on that 0.25%. My guess is it's the guys that have 1,000 acres of farmland. They're not in the top 1% or the top 0.25%. They're the ones getting hit because the top 0.25%, they hire the fancy attorneys and CPAs and great financial planners like Representative Albright and others to get around. So I'm saying I don't think the top 2% are probably paying this. They have trusts in South Dakota or wherever.
That's right.
And so I don't think they're paying it because these people are rich. They're not stupid. And I would argue, I wouldn't argue, I would suggest, because I'm not an argumentative person, I would suggest that the top 2% that everybody likes to hate, they're not paying this. It's the guy that didn't have the Gucci suit guy with the, you know, attorney or the whatever, three-piece suit guy, helping him out. And so, Mr. Michael, is there any data on who's paying the estate tax? Is it the top 2%? Didn't they have their attorneys doing the right thing for him or what?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there's sort of a lively debate among some of the researchers in this area about the extent to which the estate tax is a, quote, voluntary tax. You know, and I think there isn't a total consensus on that, but I think, you know, that there's certainly, it's you're able to minimize the tax quite a bit, but it's hard to, if you're, you know, a mega rich person, to avoid it totally. It's easier to avoid a state tax, obviously, because you can do one of two things. One, because no states other than Connecticut have gift taxes. If you give substantial amounts of your wealth away before you die, you avoid the tax. Or, as the members who are supporting these bills have pointed out, if you change your domicile, you can avoid the tax on everything except real property that you own in the state. You know, the gift tax element of it, the absence of a gift tax element of it, is what, you know, makes it easier to avoid than anything else.
Representative Lesch.
No, that's it, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay, let's go to Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and, you know, either to the authors or to Mr. Michael. I think it's been said several times here that are implied that this is double taxation and that these people have already paid taxes and all that. And I'm still learning all this stuff, but I kind of get a sense that that's not really true of all these people that we're talking about. And, you know, we're the home of the Fortune 500, more Fortune 500 companies than anywhere else. And when the Star Tribune does that eye-popping section once in a while that lists all these salaries and the stock options and all that other stuff, I'm kind of amazed by the size of the numbers. And I suspect some of these people, it's not the farmland, it's their paper investments. And they made the right choices at the right time. They negotiated the right golden parachute. They got something. And my understanding is if you can inherit that and establish a new basis without having ever paid taxes on the growth in that value. Is that correct?
I would say that you bring up a very good point. In that specific situation where you own stocks or whatever, or it could be farmland, and the person dies before they've given it away or sold it, they would get the stepped-up basis on that property. Mr. Michael, where have they then? That might be a loophole. I like that. That's a good thought. Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it certainly is true that the appreciation let me put it this way. When you own property on death and transfer it on death, there's a step up in basis. So if one has appreciation in property that passes to an heir on death, that appreciation avoids the income taxation on the capital gain that results from that. Now, if you give the property away during your lifetime, then the recipient or of the gift gets a carryover basis, and so they will, if they ultimately dispose of the property, will incur the capital gain tax. So I think it's fair, as I heard Representative Albright say during his remarks, that labor income, so, and that includes not just, you know, wages and self-employment income, but for the people that you see in the, you know, business pages who get large stock options, that's labor income, and that ultimately, when those unqualified stock options are granted, those are taxable to them, and they do pay tax on it. So it's not, there's not the appreciation there, but people who have, you know, made investments and have substantial appreciation, or own a business that they have a very low basis in that passes on, yes, that appreciation is not subject to income tax. And, you know, the conventional wisdom is that's one of the functions of the estate tax, is to provide a backup to that. But, of course, it also taxes labor income that's been taxed before and realized capital gains that has been taxed before, too.
Mr. Chair.
Loeffler. And then we'll go to Representative Albright. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it just sounds to me like we need to get some information on what percentage of this is really just, to me, in my mind, sort of catch-up taxation. On earnings that you got because you happened to pick the right stock at the right time and it was successful. I mean, I know there's people who pick stocks at the wrong time and they're not successful and they get losses, but, you know, some people have done very, very well just, and it's not through the sweat of their brow and working hard and creating that family business. It's just about picking the right thing. It's kind of like picking the right horse. And, you know, if you win the lottery, you pick the right pick five, you have to pay taxes on it. So it just kind of feels to me like we ought to treat everybody the same. And the other question I had is there seemed to be an assumption that all assets are illiquid and that, you know, you're going to, the tax man's going to come and take away a chunk of your land and it isn't going to be profitable. And my understanding, you know, I mean, I know more about people who have to, like, raise money to pay for the funeral than know how to do this kind of stuff. But, you know, I assume there's reverse mortgages and things like that that you can use to get the cash to settle the tax out and still keep the business going. And if you've inherited the land and never made a mortgage payment on it, it's still a pretty good deal. Is that true that you can finance your tax payments in some way, Mr. Michael, rather than having someone come and actually put a lien or confiscate your land?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, yeah, it's obviously there are options for paying estate tax in installments, so that's one option. And, of course, as you suggest, you know, the heirs could always borrow money if they do have totally illiquid assets to, and they don't want to liquidate those assets or can't liquidate them, they can obviously borrow to pay the tax, you know, from a commercial lender.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'd like to hear from the authors how they think these pieces play into the fairness arguments on the proposals before us.
Mr. Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Loeffler, I think we have to first make a distinction in terms of the type of money we're discussing. Because as the conversation has kind of travailed through, we have to differentiate between that type of money that is in a taxable environment and the amount of money that is in a non-taxable or tax shelter environment. And when I speak of not yet taxable, I'm speaking to folks who have IRAs, 401k balances, tax sheltering mechanisms that are sponsored by their employers as a paternalistic opportunity for them to save for their retirement. When you talk about to the point of illiquid assets, cash is king. And when you talk about a net estate of, let's just say for the sake of argument, $5 or $6 million, you may very likely only have working capital of $50,000 to $75,000, and the remainder of what shows on your balance sheet is very likely working stock, your work in process, your capital improvements, to some extent, unfortunately, goodwill is included in that net worth of your estate. We discount that a little bit. But all of the issues that surround an estate that when that first death occurs, quite literally vultures show up. And rather than take the value that is on your net worth statement, the market value for that which it is worth is what the buyer is willing to buy that day. And it may be 60 cents on the dollar. It could be very likely 30 cents on the dollar. And so then you're setting up a situation where the audit, or the which all estate tax returns are audited, will go back and take a look at in terms of did you receive fair market value, or to the extent of the taxable, you have one forgiveness date, which is further out from the date of death. You have an opportunity to then say, I've got to pay on the ledger, but not on what I got. So you've got a conundrum to face in terms of you've got 50 cents on the dollar, but you owe on 100% of it. To the extent that we talk about tax shelters, an IRA, that is a taxable piece that the ERISA, Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, as amended on a yearly basis. We talk about the amortization schedule for people that have not taken money out until 70 and a half, then have to take out the fractional equivalent of the years remaining divided by that number into one. And if they don't and they die, then it's all includable in their estate as tax, not only in their income tax, but in their estate tax. So we need to differentiate between the types of money that we're talking about within the state. And to embark on a conversation about double dipping, as the chair has alluded to, it further magnifies the dilemma of taking care of those that are left behind after the death of the first death, the survivors. How are you going to take care of your spouse if you were hanging your hat entirely from your IRA, as would be example of a number of clients that really don't have a business, but they have small estates, but their IRA is includable in their estate, but that's their only form of income for the surviving spouse?
Mr.
And
Chair.
To that, you still have 4 minutes, but to that point, just thinking through this a little bit, you have a 1,000 acres, a farmer has 1,000 acres, and you had mentioned, well, couldn't they go to a bank, or somebody said something about going to a commercial lender, so now we're making that family pay for the farm that they bought and paid for twice, because now they have to go get a loan, first of all, right?
Mr. Chair, and that brings up a very good point. Let's say that an example of, someone from Preston, Minnesota dies, and they leave that 3,000 acres of good farmland to the surviving spouse. The bank is going to say, who's going to run the farm? If the husband dies, but he was the farmer, and the wife is looked upon as being now the farmer, what is her creditworthiness? How will she make good on that note? The credit quality nature of the underwriting for that loan takes on a whole new nature in terms of consideration by the bank in terms of putting that into his bank's portfolio.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Albright, I don't think you actually responded to the kind of situations that I was presenting. We always keep going back to this businessman who has this very illiquid business, and I suspect that's a really minor part of this group. And that a lot of them are people who chose to make investments in the stock market, not necessarily through tax-sheltered efforts or anything else, but they decided that was a better deal than putting it in the credit union or the bank down the block. And they were lucky. Or maybe they got paid in stock. I had a neighbor who, it's shocking to everyone, when she died, she had been one of the first employees of Deluxe Check. And when they couldn't make payroll, they gave them some stock certificates. And she put them in a file drawer. Only when she died, what she did is she created a foundation. And her $23 million is doing a lot, has done a lot of good. I suspect, anyone who invests just their own money into stocks should have to pay on that. Just like when someone works for a paycheck at $15 an hour, they got to pay income taxes. And if you happen to make your living or your savings, your nest egg, grow by picking the right stocks because you're smart and strategic or lucky, whatever it happens to be, don't you think you should have to pay at some point taxes on those gains, and that they shouldn't just be a bonus gift to your heirs who didn't put any time, labor, and effort into it? They just happen to have a good uncle who was an investor or grandfather or whatever? I mean, what is the fairness argument I'm trying to understand? Because your bill treats everybody the like.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Albright?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Loeffler, they are treated fairly, and it's called the capital gains rate. On a yearly basis, based upon the appreciation, dividends, and income that you realize off of those after-tax investments, you have to pay a capital gains rate, which is a fair tax because it recognizes the distributions and or the accumulation that you realize off of the sweat of your intellect for the sake of being lucky. And candidly, I know a lot of folks that have stories about their investments, and 8 out of 10 have bad stories. There's only 2 that have good stories, and they say and recall those stories all the time. So it's a bit like a circular fence. But to your point, I know a lot of folks that are retiring from good-paying jobs in the schools, in the trades, and in other places that don't own businesses, but who have accumulated very nice wealth that will secure a very good retirement for them, who have not either thought of their estate as being substantial enough to necessitate going to an attorney and drawing up papers, which, by the way, have to be rekindled and reviewed about every third year based upon the tax law changes that go on at the federal end here, which costs even more money. And so they don't think of themselves as being applicable to that type of an environment. But to your point, a person who gets lucky and picks the right stock, whether it be in Datacard or Medtronic or whatnot, and they get those stock options, they are treated fairly on a yearly basis based upon the current tax code, both state and federally, as it stands today.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I didn't understand clearly Mr. Michael's explanation, but I thought you only paid when you sold those investments unless it was part of your compensation. Is that correct, Mr. Michael?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, yes, the capital gains tax is only applies on a sale or exchange of the asset.
Representative Loeffler?
Thank you. I think that makes my point, that that didn't address those situations. Thank you. Representative Lone, do you have any comments on the fairness of different types of estates under this?
Well, I guess getting to the fairness issue, and what I look at is that under our current statute, and again, it's being phased up $200,000 a year up to 2018 with the exclusion of those, you know, farms and small businesses that we have a separate policy for up to $5 million. As Representative Albright, I think, gave very compelling testimony, there are a lot of people, I think most of us would consider middle class wage earners in that, who have planned well for their retirement, probably, you know, own their home that hopefully is appreciated over the years in that. They may not realize that they actually have all in an estate that will be subject to this tax when they die because they don't consider themselves wealthy. And we have a tax policy that unless they have taken the time and the expense of doing estate tax planning with a CPA, with an attorney, with someone like Representative Albright or the chair, are going to be hit with an unplanned tax on their heirs at their death. And I think that is the point here, that our current policy hits a lot of people that most of us would not consider wealthy and may not understand that they fall into a category that we currently have a policy that is going to substantially reduce their estate at their death.
Representative Loeffler.
I'll let others.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler.
Questions.
I have Drazkowski, Simonson, Anderson, then I think we'll get to some testifiers here. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Albright and Representative Loon, for bringing these bills. Members, I'm just reminded, I live in an agricultural district, and, you know, the impact on farmers, and I think Representative Loon's point is very well taken here, especially as it relates to the farm community. There's a lot of farmers that get caught by this tax. It doesn't take a lot of farmland. I ran the numbers on this the current law, $3 million for farmers. Mr. Michael is where we're at. You know, 500-acre farm at $6,000 an acre, and both of those numbers are small. And you're there. And so, if you're a farmer, and there's a good number of them that fall into this, and you don't have the estate plan in place, and the active farmer in that family dies, what do? You end up selling out half the farm, and then at that point the farm is no longer viable because the margins are not enough in order to provide for a family at that point. These are family farms we're talking about. These are not corporate entities. We don't have a we have a corporate farm law in Minnesota that doesn't allow that to happen. We've heard from people. Representative Dabney and I were at a meeting last weekend, and the point taken from the farmer who testified before our committee was, you know what? My IRA is in my land. My farm is my IRA, is what he said. And so he doesn't have these types of investments. He doesn't have stocks. He doesn't have bonds. He doesn't have mutual funds. He's got his land. And that's it. So if we don't have some protection for these folks, what we're looking at is further erosion and destruction of these family farms brought on by government. So thank you both for bringing this bill, and I look forward to more of the discussion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The gentleman from Duluth, Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think since both of these bills are identical, this question could go to either of you that wants to answer it. But I want to embark upon a little bit of a different path and ask about the federal level that we're tying the bill to, which I think we're increasing the state exemption, the estate exemption, from $1.4 million to $5.43 million, and I believe that the bill references federal law. But my question is that $5.43 million static in law, or would that require action from Congress to change that figure, or how often does that number change?
Well, maybe go to Mr. Michael on that, the escalator on the federal. Would this bill, I think your question, would this bill have Minnesota on the escalator also? Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simonson, yes. The federal exclusion amount is indexed for inflation, and every year it gets adjusted upward, and this bill would link Minnesota to that amount, so it would increase. And I think if you look at the revenue estimate they have in there, what our economic consultant estimates that will be over the forecast window.
The gentleman from Duluth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, to the authors, would you concur with that statement?
Representative Loon?
I mean, is that an accurate statement? Or?
Representative Loon, do you disagree with Joel Michael?
Never, Mr. Chair.
Representative Loon, to the question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, my question is just simply this. I mean, you're aware of the fact that if we pass this bill the way it's written, that we will be passing an automatic inflator to the estate exemption, which is currently at $5.43 million, but that will automatically escalate and be tied to inflation going forward. Is that a fair assumption?
Representative Loon?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Simonson, I am, and I think, you know, similar to other things we've done in conformity, where, again, some of the federal tax things were put into place permanently, such as removing the marriage penalty and that. We no longer have to have action by our legislature every year because we are conforming those things. And in the point of my bill, and I think Representative Albright's as well, is that we provide that same conformity on this tax.
And, Mr. Chair, just a statement. I hope that and I agree with your position there, but I hope that position continues as we move forward. And we remember this discussion about inflation and value to the budget and the value to the fact that lawmakers don't have to come back every year and adjust as we go forward. So I appreciate that point, and I'll save the rest of my comments for the end.
Thank you, Representative Simonson. Representative Anderson, and then unless other members have questions, we'll go to some testifiers here. Chair Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I can skip if it helps you with time management. Or
I have a bill before your committee. Go ahead.
Well, you know, I think the conversation has been interesting here today. You know, I take a view of America as different, that the history of America has been that if you work hard and you earn your money, you get to keep your money, and that you shouldn't be punished for your success. And yet what I hear today is something about that there's a level of income that you can earn that's acceptable, that you can't earn beyond that, and the government's going to take care of that. I didn't realize that we were all supposed to earn the same amount. And I don't know if that magic number is 30,000 or 50,000 or 100,000 or 200,000, but I'm very concerned when I think about the fact that we are going to, as a government, decide that people can only earn so much and that they have no reason to work harder and to do a great success, and then that they can't pass that on to their children, their family, that their children shouldn't deserve to have that, that they shouldn't be able to decide how they spend their money and pass that money on to the next generation. You know, I think that this is really, you know, the difference between the individuals around this table. But it's very disconcerting to me that I can imagine that the founders right now are rolling it over in their grave, because this is exactly what they left to come to America, because they wanted to come to America. They wanted to be able to work hard, and the fruits of their labor would be able to stay in their possession. But yet we're saying here today, nope, if you earn a certain amount, that's got to go back to the government, because we know how to spend your money better. Kind of like that $137 million Senate office building. That's what we're going to spend it on. That's great. Wow. Great priorities for the state. So, folks, appreciate the conversation. It's been really enlightening, but also frightening, too. I want to know that when our kids, when we're losing the youth by droves, and we're losing the people that invest back into our communities. You don't like people that are earning this kind of money? You know what those people do? They give to the arts. They give to our schools. They give to organizations like the Alzheimer's Association. You name it. You go down the list. Those folks donate money to help others. And if we're going to start saying, nope, you can't earn that much, it's got to be $50,000, that's the mark, we are setting ourselves up for failure in the long haul. So that's my only comment, Mr. Chair.
Okay, let's go to some testifiers here. We have some from, let's start out with Stephanie from Owl Bookkeeping. And Beth Cadoon, if you could come down. And Stephanie Leitala. Well, both only counts in hand grenades Leitala. And horseshoes, but what could you help me out here? Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Stephanie Leitala Rupp.
Stephanie what?
Leitala Rupp.
Oh, you threw me off.
Leitala hyphen Rupp.
Like the old snowmobiles?
Exactly.
Rupp, okay. Light to the Rupp.
Not related. I did not inherit any of that wealth.
let's start out with Ms. Cadoon, and then you can introduce your other testifier here. Ms. Cadoon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm here in strong support of all three of these bills. We really appreciate the authors bringing them forward. Our concern is Minnesota has become more and more of a tax outlier in this area. We're only one of 14 states that still have an estate tax, and as the earlier author had said, other states are moving to increase the thresholds that still have this estate tax to match the federal level, most recently New York and I believe Maryland last year as well. We've been hearing as we go around the state more and more from individuals, CPAs, financial planners, attorneys, business owners, really on the detrimental impact of the estate tax in Minnesota. It is becoming more and more of a disincentive to remain in the state as well as to invest in Minnesota. I think you're going to hear further testimony on that, so I won't go into that any further. But as you look at our demographic changes, as you look at the baby boomers that are hitting retirements, this is when they're really going to be starting to make these decisions. And I think that's something that's really, as you know, we have static analysis on our revenue estimates. And so it's showing a revenue loss to the state. But I think when you look at the wealth potential of that, the out-migration of these individuals with the wealth that they bring in with them, that it really is a detrimental impact on Minnesota moving forward with loss of revenues to the state, with the loss of their involvement in their communities, the loss of charitable giving potential for these individuals as well. And so we really hope that this is something that can move forward, that you can look on how we can match at least the federal estate tax threshold level. And we think that would be an important step forward, as well as just making our tax system much more simpler, as well as the administrative complexity it costs for the estate tax. Thank you.
And Ms. Cadoon, I understand where the revenue comes from and that it's static. I get all that. Are you aware, maybe we could talk offline, of any resources that would say, okay, if we do this, yeah, it costs this, but we bring in this? Are there any studies out there like that?
Mr. Chair, maybe we'll have to talk offline on that and do a little more research. I know there has been research regarding that the impact of the estate tax on with some out-migration. I don't think there's been any analysis that I've seen specific to Minnesota regarding kind of that more dynamic analysis.
Okay. To that point, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I would expect if that were true that the numbers would come true and out biennia as well. You know, for years we've been trying to say that for every dollar invested in early childhood, you get seven back, and we can never book, you know, we can't ever book that savings. So I anticipate you wouldn't be able to book this savings either. But I did have a question for Ms. Cadoon, Mr. Chair. If that's
okay, Representative Lesh.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Cadoon, you know, your organization has consistently testified that the high taxes in Minnesota, as you characterize them, is responsible for out-migration from the state. And not just with the estate tax, but with business taxes. And I'm having a tough time justifying that with Minnesota being the number two in Fortune 500 companies per capita in Minnesota. And either you're just wrong, or B, our quality of life in Minnesota more than makes up for that in our homegrown talent. So why do we have nothing more than anecdotal evidence that the suggestion that these taxes are responsible for out-migration?
Thank you, Representative Lesh. I've always wondered about that when they say this bill, for every dollar spent, we get $7. They say, heck with the whole budget in there. I mean, you know,
that's right.
I think ethanol is $1 for 17. Ms. Cadoon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Lesh, appreciate your question on that. I think when you look at regarding our tax climate, there's a lot of factors that go into a strong business climate in the state. One is having good, strong infrastructure. And as I always said, we believe we also need to provide that at a competitive price. We've had some recent very large tax increases in the last 2 years, over $2 billion of tax increases that brought our individual income tax rate as well as our pass-through rate up to the fourth highest in the nation. We were able to repeal some of those taxes that we were having a more immediate impact, such as the business-to-business taxes, the gift tax that we were hearing just immediate concern on those as well. I don't think we've ever said as an organization regarding that that high taxes result in out-migration. We know there's a lot of factors involved in people making those decisions, but we do know there is some research that does say for those high marginal tax rates, especially for entrepreneurs and individuals, that they do have an impact on their decisions on where they're going to grow, invest, and be, have their residence. So we do know there is some data that supports that. The other thing to take into account when you're looking at our tax climate and some of the recent tax changes that occurred, as well as looking around the country and some of the tax choices that other states are making and reducing their taxes, reducing their business taxes, and reducing their estate tax impact, is that a lot of these decisions are incremental. People don't immediately make a change. That they're now slowly kind of looking and getting some advice from financial planners and others on some of their decisions that they have. And these are things that are going to kind of play out over the next few years. And we're going to see that in some of our economic data as well, I think, over the next few years as well.
Chair Lesh.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Let's go to Ms. Rupp. Ms. Rupp, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Stephanie Lytle Rupp. I own a company called Owl Bookkeeping and CFO Services, and we provide, as you might imagine, bookkeeping and CFO services to companies in the million to 20 million range. We have 30 employees and are based here in St. Paul. We are a small business, working with small business. I grew up in a small family business. For me, the estate tax is less about transferring of the business or assets from one generation to another than being a competitive, vibrant state. My business is small. It's geocentric. The likelihood that I will move my business out of state, zero. The probability that I will sell my business and move myself out of state and start another one, more than zero. I have to tell you, I couple of years ago would never have even thought that. It wouldn't have even entered my head. I am born and raised here. My family is here. My friends are here. I'm deeply committed to the community. I sit on 5 boards of directors. I give lots of money. I volunteer my time. I am an unusual small business person. I get that. I am here spending over an hour doing something I believe in. I am unusual. You want me in this state. But suddenly, if I were dating this state and we were in a relationship, based on some decisions that happened last year, I would say that you're doing the, I'm going to make this a little uncomfortable, so you'll break up with me instead. This, the business to business that was passed and then repealed because universally people thought it was a horrible idea. The fourth tier, but here's the one thing that happened with that tax is small business owners took notice. They said, wait a minute, what? What are you doing? Holy cow. So when the fourth tier income tax passed, all eyes were on you. And even if they didn't hit that, the thing about the land of the free and opportunity is they aspire to hit it. People aspire to hit that kind of revenue, and they want to be able to do it. And now suddenly, not very friendly to be here. It doesn't feel like a place where I want to invest more of my time and money. One of the things we don't talk about in polite conversation and politically correct conversation is we need prosperous people for a state to work. We talk a lot about needing smart people. We talk a lot about needing educated people because we have some industries in our state that need smart, educated people, but we fail to make the connection that smart people often are compensated with money. Those two things go hand in hand. The hitch in the giddy-up with smart, prosperous people is they have choices. Money buys choices. Those people who have mobile businesses and make a lot of money and stock options, they're already gone. This already isn't where they want to be. And in a world of perfect information that includes the internet, obviously, they can choose where they want to go, and they're smart enough to do it. And smart people are in demand. Businesses and cities across the country will woo them to say, join our team. Please, join our team. This is incremental. Last year was the first time I felt maybe I shouldn't be a Minnesotan, even though I am a Minnesotan. These things take time. It takes time to sell a business. It takes time to decide to do that. You want to not rush into this. We talk about being Fortune 500 companies, but we haven't had one start here or move here in a couple of decades. These are all homegrown companies. This is good, but that's telling us something, that they're not choosing to move here, but they are choosing to move other states. Minnesota has become an incredibly expensive place to live if you are smart and therefore prosperous. And sadly, it's also an expensive place to die. We are one of 14 states that have an estate tax. The rest of the country has figured out that it's a bad strategy to ask the people with the most money to leave. We need to do that. And so I would prefer it be annihilated, the estate tax in Minnesota, but I wholeheartedly support the bill that's on the table right now to at least raise it to the federal threshold. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And to the witness, what if you're not smart, but you are prosperous?
Dumb luck. It's your money.
Works for me. Okay. With that, questions for Ms. Rupp? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you, Ms. Cadoon. Let's go to the Nelson family. Peter and Scott, you want to join us down here together? Let's go with Scott, and then we'll go to Peter. Thanks for having the last name Nelson. I just don't like messing up people's last names. Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Scott Nelson. I'm a CPA and also work as an attorney. I'm a trust and estate lawyer, but I'm here on behalf of the CPA Society. And I was prepared to comment and provide commentary that's already been suggested, so I'm going to try to pick and choose my comments here. What I'd really like to do is just spend a few minutes and talk on the practical side of how our state-only estate tax system works in practice. First of all, just to a couple of recent comments, I did bring the Forbes article that, you know, mentioned that we're one of the states not to die, and we've actually been on that list since 2010, by the way. If you go on the web, they'll show the whole list there for you. I have, just to be on the extreme side, I have lost clients as residents of Minnesota, and the most extreme was a couple in their mid-40s. They immigrated here from France. They settled in the Twin Cities. They opened a retail establishment. They have a worldwide web business that is generating millions of dollars. About a year ago, they chose to migrate to Florida for all of the above reasons: tax, income tax, sales tax, property tax, estate tax. And again, you know, we go by anecdote, but I've seen it in practice. I am one of those people that help people decide where they should migrate, and I do counsel them that every state's got to raise revenue somehow, so you got to be careful. You know, you go to Florida, you pay a high sales tax because they, of course, work on the tourist industry there. You pay a lot of tax when you buy your hotel room. You know, so in any case, I understand that every state has to raise revenue somehow. Maybe they have oil revenue or other natural resources. So again, you know, I don't belittle the fact that we do need tax revenue, but obviously people are making decisions based on these policies. We mentioned New York and Maryland. New York was at $1 million like we were, and we were compared quite often to New York on the estate tax side. And as they mentioned, they actually did just enact a system that will increase their estate tax exemption to $5.25 million by the year 2017. So, you know, they're considered a high tax jurisdiction, but even they have decided that the state estate tax was not worth having that lower exemption. In the there was a report that was issued by the Minnesota Department of Revenue last session that was actually commissioned by the legislature talking about the estate tax system. And if you look at that report, it actually says that estate tax is a very unstable source of income. And I know from a good tax policy standpoint, we like to look for stable sources of income. And by itself, it's a very unstable source. We've also talked about, you know, whether it's the top 2% or the top 0.25% that are actually going to pay the estate tax. If you look at that study from the Minnesota Department of Revenue, it shows that about 50% of the estate tax comes from the estates that are over $5 million. So, in other words, if we raise the exemption to the federal exemption as we speak today, we'd only be talking about cutting our projected revenue from the estate tax by about 50%. And we also should point out that a lot of the, you know, if you look over the period of time, we have a lot of glitches in our annual revenues from estate tax depending on when particular wealthy individuals have died. And that's not going to go away if we conform to the federal exemption. We're still going to have those wealthy individuals who will die, and the state will fortunately benefit from the estate tax that they still have to pay. So again, we need to kind of keep in mind that. The other point that I wanted to build on, Mr. Chair, that you'd made is that I don't believe, at least in my practice, that I'm seeing the estate tax hit the top 2%. If they're my clients, they're not paying the estate tax because we do the proper planning, so they don't have to do that. But where I get clients who come in after mom or dad have died and they're paying the estate tax, they are the middle class that we consider. These are the people that have earned pensions, retirement plans. They have equity in their house. We also include life insurance. Some of you may or may not be aware of that, but if you own your life insurance, the death benefit is included in your taxable estate. So it's very easy to get up to $1.4 million without even talking about the farmers and the qualified small businesses and all the others that we have involved. But my practice is showing that it is hitting the people that we don't really consider the top 2% of the wealthy in our state. I just wanted to then also just spend a couple of minutes talking about the practical side of a state-only system. We've got a lot of, I have to commend the legislature. Mr. Michael has been very involved in all this during the last several years. But we have come a long ways in removing a lot of the glitches in our state-only system. And going to the standalone system that we now have as of last year has helped to remove some of those obstacles too. But I wanted to point out some of the problems that we are still having with the state-only system that we have.
Mr. Nelson, could you please wrap it up here?
Sure.
I hate to do that to you, but I've got about six other people here.
Okay. Well, I just want to make a couple of quick points. Obviously, conformity, many of you have heard, the conformity from the CPA's perspective on the income tax side. Obviously, conformity is going to make it easier for people to do their tax returns. If you have a state-only estate tax, we have many clients who are having to prepare federal returns in order to do the state estate tax form. So again, we're creating a lot more complexity. We're creating a lot more business for me. Again, I have to do a lot, we're basically doing a lot of the estate planning that the whole country did when the federal estate tax was much lower. Now that the federal estate tax is higher, most of the country doesn't have to do that planning, but we still do in Minnesota. So it is a good business generator for me. There's a lot of glitches in the qualified farm and qualified small business exclusions that we've talked about. We have this special exclusion.
Mr. Nelson, that was my bill. Proceed, please.
Yep.
About all the glitches.
Mr. Chair, it was an excellent bill, and it's the policy is the policy is beautiful. It's exactly, obviously we want to encourage small business and farms in our state. But again, we're still running into glitches with people in the states actually qualifying for those exclusions. Again, I know as we speak, I've been emailing an attorney in Alexandria who represents kind of the outstate attorneys in the Minnesota State Bar Association, and they actually are working on bills this session with the farmers to try to clarify some of the glitches that they've run into with their farm clients qualifying for the exclusion. It involves revocable trusts. There's some issues with the typical example where the farmers retire and maybe they, rent the property in their last few years of life. Maybe they move into assisted living or a nursing home, and the questions have come up, can the family still qualify for the farm exclusion? Parents farmed for 45 years. They lived in a nursing home for the last 3 years. There should be ways for them to qualify for that farm exclusion. So those are some glitches. One of the things that I've run into that I wanted to mention is that I have some non-resident attorney clients who have called me. And one of the issues that we've run into is that the state-only estate tax is based on the gross value of the estate. So when you take the value of Minnesota property, you compare that to their total estate, and then you compute the Minnesota estate tax based on that ratio. Well, what happens is, in those instances, you don't take into account that the property is passing to a surviving spouse. Under the federal law, we've always given an exclusion for property passing between spouses. Well, as an example, let's say we have an Iowa couple that owns real estate or a farm in Minnesota. If the farm is going to pass, let's say they own it as joint tenants with right of survivorship. If the husband dies and the farm is going to pass to the surviving spouse, we give no marital deduction for that. We tax that non-resident on the value of their Minnesota farmland, regardless of the fact that it's going to a surviving spouse. The other issue that we've run into related to that is if it goes
Mr.
to
Nelson,
charity.
How many more issues are there?
I'll cut myself off here. I have plenty more. But
I'd rather you do it than me, because that'd be very ungentlemanly of me.
No, I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. I just, again, wanted to highlight, again, we talk about the policy, but we also need to talk about the practical side that CPAs, have to struggle with. And, of course, we're the messengers to these people and to the families when we're trying to struggle through these issues. But it also, the last point that I was making is if the property goes to charity, the estate still pays the Minnesota estate tax on that Minnesota property. There's no deduction for the amount going to charity, again, which is completely contrary to tax law. The last point that I'll finish up with, again, which is bad tax policy as far as we're concerned, is that if you have a state-only estate tax, there is no step-up in basis because we conform to the federal law on the income tax side. So if you have a state-only estate tax, in other words, you have an estate below $5.43 million, you're going to have to pay Minnesota estate tax, but you get no step-up in basis because there's no step-up at the federal level. So again, we have an inconsistency there, and we want to make sure that if we are going to have a state-only system, that we have a good system that works on a good tax policy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you. Mr. Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Peter Nelson. That's Nelson with an O-N, just to be clear, since there's some questions about our name, I believe. I'm Peter Nelson with Center of the American Experiment. I'm the Director of Public Policy, and as an organization, we aim to promote policies that deliver a culture of prosperity to the state of Minnesota. And part of that, we believe, has a lot to do with our tax code and minimizing the tax impact, the negative tax impacts on our economy. And we released over the past 6 months recommendations that cover a broad range of issues, including taxes. And you should all have a book, hopefully, that you received yesterday that has all of these recommendations. One of those recommendations is to eliminate the estate tax over a phased 6-year period. So we really do prefer eliminating estate tax. However, we do believe that this is a strong first step toward that goal. Simply put, we don't believe that the estate tax, the cost that that imposes on our economy, justify the minimal revenue that it delivers. And right now I want to talk just a little bit more about that revenue side and also about the migration data and the empirical studies that are out there, because there's a lot of, I think, questions on that data. So first off, I just want to make some quick points on the revenue. We heard a little bit before today that maybe, you know, despite the fact that in 2014 the estate tax brought in $177 million, on net it might not have actually brought in that much money, because if it reduces economic activity in this state, if it dissolves businesses, if it encourages people to leave the state, and that economic activity leaves, we have less revenue from other sources. We have less revenue from income taxes. And there is some research out there to show that that actually happens, that people are responsive. I was just reading last night a study. It's not on the estate tax, but it is on capital gains taxes. And that study basically concluded that when you raise the estate tax rate, you lose about, when you raise the capital gains rate, you lose about 66% of that rate increase over time as people modify their behavior. And Minnesota is an outlier on that tax issue as well. And I think you would see that the same thing happens with our estate tax. So that's the revenue point I want to make here. Now, on migration issues, we've been very concerned as an organization about how our tax policy is influencing people's decisions to move out of the state or to move into the state. And in many respects, we're more concerned about people not moving into the state. However, with the estate tax, it's clearly focused on people leaving the state. So a couple years ago, I looked at this IRS data, and I think many of you are probably familiar with the fact that the IRS collects data on every movement of every return across state borders, across county borders. This is not a sample set. This is every return. And it includes the return and the income attached to that return. So we know where income is moving across the country. And so I looked at where income is moving in and out of the state of Minnesota. And between 1995 and 2010, $5.1 billion in 2010 dollars moved out of the state on net. I dug a little deeper and looked at where is this money going. And the top 10 states where this money left to, tend to be lower tax states. The top 10 states where the state of Minnesota received money from tend to be higher tax states. And when you break that down and you look at the estate tax, as of 2010, because there has been some changes since 2010 in what states have an estate tax, back in 2010, only two of the top 10 states where money left Minnesota to go to had an estate tax. Of the 10 states where we received money, 7 of those 10 states had an estate tax. Now, I'm always very careful to say that, look, this is not proving that people are moving because of our estate tax. This is, obviously, people move for a lot of reasons. People move because of the climate. People move because of a job, home pricing, and this data doesn't control for all of that. However, there is some recent data that does control for that using this data set. It's not related to the estate tax. It's related to our top marginal tax rates. And using this same data set, the three economists at the New Jersey Department of Treasury looked at this data set and found, and after controlling for various factors, found that, yes, indeed, a state's top tax rate does influence where people move. And this is 2014 research that is in a peer-reviewed journal. And so that research is there. I want to conclude with a brief discussion on the Minnesota state tax study that came out in January of 2014. I have some issues with that study because I don't believe it characterizes the migration studies that are out there, the other empirical studies, as well as it could. It correctly identified the important studies. But if a casual reader would be led to believe that these studies basically show that there's really no real impact, migration impact, from an estate tax. And what they missed was they really didn't identify the limitations of all these studies real well. And they did identify some of them, and I just want to go through the major limitations that there are in those studies. The first one is that many of these estate tax studies identify movement, widespread movement in the elderly, every elderly person. It's not focused on the wealthy elderly. Obviously, with the estate tax, we're concerned with the wealthy elderly out there. And the other problem that these studies then have is that when they do finally try to actually study the movement of the wealthy, you have to go to that subpopulation, and the data sets are just too small to work with. And so you receive a number of errors within those data sets. And so for those two reasons, it's the empirical research out there is just very limited. And there is one study out there, which I believe I saw passing around or something. I wrote about this, so I'll let you read that and not take your time today talking about that, but you can read my full analysis of the estate tax study afterwards. With that, I want to conclude by saying basically, okay, look, if the empirical research out there really isn't giving us good information one way or the other, we better listen real hard to that anecdotal evidence that we're hearing today. That is, in my opinion, the best evidence we have out there over what is happening in this state. And so please listen, remember what you heard before me, and please remember what you hear after me. Thank you.
Okay, we'll take one question here, Representative Loeffler, and then we'll go to the three remaining witnesses. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you. Mr. Nelson, as you're looking for empirical evidence and what's going on, I would suggest that you look into the research in Health and Human Services, which is doing a lot of work to prepare for the age wave and the aging of the baby boomers. And there's a lot of evidence that people move early in life for jobs. Late in life, early retirement, they might move for amenities, which means getting out of winter. We know all about that. But they disproportionately fly back home and stay home for assistance. And that people, when they get to that point in life, and we'll all get there eventually, who need a little extra help, you go where your kids are, you go where your friends are, you go where the church that you've had a long-term relationship with is, and that there's a tremendous amount of evidence about people coming back home to Minnesota who might have, when they're in their late 60s, said, hey, I want to golf every other day, and I'm going to go pick up seashells along the shore. But when they're no longer able to do that, and they're using a walker, they're seeing their abilities and their dependencies, their abilities decrease, their dependencies increase, they come back home, and that's a real impact on our Health and Human Services budget. And if some of them stay here till they die and contribute to the costs of other elders who need our help, I think that's kind of a nice trade-off. But I'd say if you're looking for research, you might be able to find it there.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Let's go to the final three. I think we can wrap this up yet today. Let's go to Mr. Hickey, Mr. Busselman, and Mr. Skillbred. in maybe about a couple minutes each. Then we'll have questions. And members, we can bring this up at a later time, too. And if you have questions, please go offline. I don't like cutting people off at all, but I think we should wrap this up today, and it'll come up later as we debate this. So let's go, Mr. Hickey. Please state your name and who you represent for the record. A couple minutes, then we'll go to Mr. Busselman and Mr. Skilbrick.
Mr. Chairman, members, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. And what a great discussion today. I'm glad I heard every witness. Wanted to thank the three authors for bringing the bill forward. It's a very important bill. And, Mr. Chairman, I'm starting to get a positive feeling here. I don't know, maybe it's false karma, but maybe this is finally the year. And you made a huge effort for us in 2011 when we finally succeeded on the farm and the small business carve-out. And I don't know how you got that done during the government shutdown, but I was happy to see one of our top priorities, thanks to you, got accomplished. Last year we made some more progress. We're phasing into 2 million, as you know, but we're still far away from accomplishing what we're trying to do here, and that is conform to the federal exemption and make life easier and simpler and send a very positive message to a lot of people across this state. A lot of you are familiar with National Federation of Independent Business. We're probably one of the most affected groups by this bill. We have many small businesses and farms that are trying to keep a family tradition going. They're trying to pass on a family-held business and a family-held farm to their heirs and their children, and this law really gets in the way of that. It forces a lot of additional and unnecessary financial planning, purchase of life insurance, and a lot of other negative side effects that don't need to have happen. It would be nice if we could eliminate that need. I think one of the most compelling things we heard today was about how it's really not the top 2%ers who are paying this. These people get involved in elaborate trusts, get a lot of good advice from the Gucci set, and you know, people who do run into this are the hardworking farmer, small business owner, and never put enough effort into this, never thought to really seek the advice, and then point of death happens if you don't take advantage of the A and B trust, and your spouse passes suddenly, you've lost half your, you know, you've lost your ability to double the exemption at whatever level it is. And so these are the kind of situations we run into. If we could finally achieve this, it would be a great accomplishment for family-held businesses and farms, giving them some certainty and dependability. And appreciate all your efforts on this. I want to thank the authors for bringing the bill forward.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Mr. Busselman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For your record, I'm Doug Busselman. I am the Director of Public Policy for the Minnesota Farm Bureau. Minnesota Farm Bureau policy supports conformity of the federal exclusion levels. We appreciate the several legislative proposals that are working to improve the situation that Minnesota farm families and others are dealing with in regard to estate taxes, and we look forward to working with the committee further in making those happen. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Skilbred.
My name is David Skilbred. I'm the lobbyist for the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. Number one, I want to thank the authors of Representative Albright, Detmer, and Loon for bringing this before us. Secondly, we've had anecdotal stories, but I got this message from one of my bankers yesterday, and this is what it says. I'm very sorry that our community and state lost a retired man and his wife to a southern state where they have no state income tax or state estate tax. He was a retired professional man, was on our hospital board, and had a very successful career, and contributed to the area. Our rural county with 11,000 people cannot afford to have people leave our area because of taxes. I'm sure there are many others who will do the same, and they will make sure that they meet all the requirements that revenue requires. Minnesota needs to have lower income taxes and higher estate tax exemptions so we don't lose more important folks of our state. Secondly, I want to just talk about the liquidity issue. My bankers say that comes up quite often. There's an estate that's in transfer, and the problem is that the majority of the value of the estate is in stuff. Land, machines, cars, houses, whatever. And now all of a sudden a brother and a sister or the kids have a tax bill of $400,000, and they have no idea how to pay for it except sell some of the inheritance. So that's kind of the way it rolls out, and that's unfortunate. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. And members, we have to get out of this room. So what we'll do here is we've taken the testimony. These bills will be before this committee, so the discussion's not over. If some members feel they didn't get some questions asked if they wanted to, if that's okay with the committee here. So what I'll do is I'll move that House File 82 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. I'll move that House File 96 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. I'll move that House File 148 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. So, members, we still have these bills. I don't want to cut anybody off from any questions on this. So they're still in the possession of the committee, and we will go forward from there. So that being said, any things to wrap up here? Good government all the time. We are adjourned.